Good morning, this is Hugh LaFollin, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'll be talking with Martha Nussbaum, Ernst Freund Distinguished Professor of Law and Philosophy at the University of Chicago, and our topic will be cosmopolitan emotions. Martha, glad to have you back on the show.
Well, Hugh, it's very good to be back on the show.
I want to spend some time talking about certain specific emotions, but before we do, we need to talk a little bit about your general theory of emotions and how it contrasts with what might be considered the ordinary view of emotions. It's a theme that you develop and discuss in some detail in your recent book, Upheavals of Thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we might even begin with that title. And the title is actually taken from Proust, from a part of the novel where the Baron de Charlus has just fallen in love. And what Proust says is that in this mind, which previously was like a flat plane, suddenly there's a mountain range standing up, as thrown up as if by geological upheavals of thought. And then these mountains have names like suffering, pride, astonishment, and love. Now, what does he mean by calling the emotions geological upheavals of thought? I think, and of course I think he's right about this, that what he's saying is emotions just are not like having a stomach ache or having some particular feeling in your body, but they involve your thought about what's most important in the world. When you love somebody, all of your thinking revolves around that person. You invest that person with a tremendous value. When you grieve for somebody who's lost, that partly involves the thought that somebody tremendously important has gone. So a part of the emotion is the thought about an object, and it's a thought of a particular kind, a thought that invests this object with great value. So Proust's image captures that idea by thinking of it as mountains that project outward towards this very important object. So this is, I think, something that we really do believe when we think hard about our emotions, but there are kinds of sloppy ways we fall into, and I think philosophers are as guilty of this as anyone, of thinking that emotions are just like gusts of wind or like having a backache or something, that they're just feelings that have no connection with our thoughts, intentions, and plans. So I try in the book to lay out carefully, looking closely at an example of my own grief at my mother's death, the reasons we have for thinking that Proust is right, that emotions really do involve thought.
Okay, sort of an indirect way, I suppose, of getting at that. I mean, let's look at some of those more ordinary views that you do discuss. One of them certainly you mentioned, and perhaps the most predominant, is when people think of emotions, they think of them, or tend to think of them primarily as feeling something that just happens to them. And in particular, that we're often passive in the face of the emotion. People talk about being overcome by grief or consumed by anger, and that indicates a certain kind of passivity and the fact that the emotions are often experienced as having some kind of overwhelming force. What do you say to someone who says, but that's really what emotions are? They really are these feelings. They really are these things which just come over us, which have this dominant force over us, and are often contrasted with rationality. I mean, you're wanting to say that they are defined in part by thought, and yet a lot of people think that they are in opposition to thought.
Well, I think what's interesting is that this idea of emotions as things that surge up, that take us over, that have great strength, these are ideas that are shared by people, on the one hand, who think that emotions have nothing to do with thought, and by theorists like the ancient Greek and Roman Stoics, who have a very extreme view and think that emotions are nothing but a certain kind of thought. So these experiences don't yet tell us how they should be classified and interpreted. And clearly, the experience of being passive before an emotion is something that any good theory of emotion has to explain. But let's see what the best explanation of that is. Now, what the ancient Greek Stoics thought is that what's really going on here is that we, through our emotional responses, we're registering things that happen out there in the world toward which we are passive because we have invested so much of our concern in an uncertain world of objects. So the idea being that once you form an attachment to some object out there that's in the control of chance, like a child, let's say you love your child, well then, you are all set up for various forms of passivity because you will have immediately reasons for fear, fear involving the thought that this precious object is threatened, because there are, of course, threats of all kinds in the world. You'll have reasons ultimately, no doubt, for anger, because this precious object may be damaged by somebody else or may even quite well damage you. You will have reasons often for grief if the precious object dies and you can't do anything to bring it back. So the idea is that those emotions register what's happening in the world to an object that you've invested a lot of your good fortune in and an object that you can't control. And in fact, by the way, evolutionary biologists tend to agree with that kind of account. They think that the contribution that emotions made in our evolutionary prehistory is precisely the fact that they do register for a creature, not just humans, but other animals too, how things are faring with their precious objects, with the good and ill of the things they care about. So through fear, an animal is alerted to how things are with, let's say, its food supply or threats to its bodily safety or something. So there's a cognitive contribution that the emotion makes that's crucial in getting the animal to focus on what it might do to stave off that threat or whatever. So in short, we can explain the passivity as a kind of passivity before the world. When I mourn for my mother, I feel completely unable to control the fact that she's died and she's been taken from me. And I feel that the grief that surges over me is something that comes from the world, but, you know, not in the sense that it has nothing to do with my evaluations. I wouldn't have grief if I didn't see my mother as enormously valuable, if I thought of her as just like a piece of my bookshelf here in front of me. I'm standing in my office. Of course, I wouldn't have grief if my bookshelf fell down. I might be mad a little bit, but my mother, it's because I think of her as at the very center of my life that the inability of me to control her life and death leads to this alarming and terrible passivity when she actually dies. So I think that we can explain the passivity that way. The feeling of tremendous force, I think we explain by the fact that these are our most important objects. Emotions don't concern things that we have only a trivial investment in. If I find one day that my toothbrush is gone, unless I'm very pathologically attached to my toothbrush, I will not feel grief, nor will I feel a particular anger if somebody else walks off with my toothbrush. But it's the things we care about greatly, and so, of course, the impact of their good or ill is great upon us. So I think in all these ways we can do justice to those very sound intuitions about emotional experience while keeping the idea that they're about an object, that they concern thoughts about the object, and that the thoughts involve ascribing great value to the object. Now, then one might ask, but is the thought all there is? And I said a little while ago that the Stoics take a very extreme view. They say, yes, the thought is all there is. I take a more mixed view. I say that feelings, bodily changes, and so on are often, of course, a very prominent part of our emotional experience. What I think we have to recognize is that these feelings fluctuate, and they're often very variable, while the thoughts remain constant. So let's say when I'm grieving, I might one time feel totally wiped out with exhaustion, and at other moments I might feel filled with extra energy, and yet I'd be grieving all the time. When you love somebody, you go through kaleidoscopic feelings, but perhaps you don't want to say that any one of those feelings has got to be there in order for the love itself to be there. And then, sometimes, we can have the emotion without feeling anything at all. And I think very often, there are emotions that linger in the background of our life that motivate our actions, and we're not even really aware of them in the sense of feeling anything in particular. I'm afraid of death right now. I'm afraid of death all the time, and it motivates very many things that I do, but I'm not trembling in my boots. I'm focusing on talking to you. That doesn't mean that the fear of death isn't lurking there in the background. And for those reasons, I don't want to say that any particular feeling has to be there in order for us to be justified in saying that the emotion is there. And yet, I'm happy to say that feelings are often a very important part of that experience.
All right. It seems then to be fair to say, if I can come up with this way of putting it, that on your view, the emotions can be seen as forms of thought that concern or take the particular form they do because of the two V's, the fact that we value things and we value things very deeply, and the fact that we're vulnerable, that our attachment to those things that we value is something over which we do not have complete control.
Yes, I think you've put it beautifully.
That then, on your view, is going to be deeply tied up with the idea that the emotions are an important part of morality. I wonder if you can expand on that a bit.
Yeah, well, of course, I think when we're dealing with non-human animals, there will be a sense of their good and ill that will be involved in their emotions, but not much in the way of a moral debate about which objects they should choose or what kind of conception of good or ill they should have. When we deal with human adults, of course, we have a certain feeling that we have choices about which objects we should invest ourselves in, which objects should we grieve for, which objects should we care about. Now, to some extent, we're not altogether free, and I think the Stoics were superficial here. The Stoics actually did think that we could change our emotional life. I mean, they thought it took laborious reconditioning and that there were a lot of entrenched habits here. But because they didn't think a whole lot about childhood and our history, they thought we were fairly transparent to ourselves, that we didn't have to ferret out the deeper prehistory of our attachments in the attachments of a young child. And so now I devote a lot of my book to talking about childhood and development and about how the past shadows the present. So I want to say right away that I think any moral debate about emotions has got to contend against the entrenched rootedness of the emotions in a childhood history over which we don't always have a lot of control or even knowledge. And yet, nonetheless, we do have questions to pose to ourselves, like, is it right to care about our own children exclusively and not to care about what happens to other people's children who are impoverished and who may be dying? Is it right to feel compassion when a fellow American dies and not to feel compassion when somebody dies over in Rwanda? Now, we can then criticize our emotions morally, and of course that needn't already mean changing them, but if we criticize them, we can at least hope to teach our own children differently, and perhaps we may even change our own emotions. I think people sometimes are able to cease to have, let's say, racial hatred that they did have at one time, and they can certainly teach their children not to have the emotions that they themselves do have, but they criticize.
Well, you mentioned compassion. I mean, could you give a little bit more in the way of an elaboration of what your account of compassion is? Because I think it helps illuminate your general view of the emotions.
Yeah, sure. I spend actually three whole chapters of the book on compassion because I think it's a very important emotion because of the way that it enables us to bridge the narrower, intense cares of the personal life and the more generalized concerns that morality tells us we ought to have. I think there are people who think that you can get people to be moral without thinking at all about their emotions, but I'm certainly not one of them. I think that you really can't just expect people to act well out of duty alone. You have to think about what they're attached to, what they really care about. And so, luckily enough, we do have a capacity through our imagination to enter the situation of another. Now, compassion in the way that most philosophers have tended to define it in the philosophical tradition involves several thoughts about another person. It involves first the thought that the person is suffering in some non-trivial way. In other words, more than losing a toothbrush, to go back to my earlier example. Second, that the suffering wasn't entirely their fault. I mean, we don't tend to feel compassion if we think, oh, that person is a bad person who brought all the suffering on himself. So at least not entirely their fault. And third, we usually think that the person has similar possibilities to us. I don't think this is an entirely necessary element because I think we can have compassion for non-human animals whom we don't see as similar to ourselves and so on, but often there's some sort of link we form in our minds. And then finally, what I want to stress is that we have to see that person as part of our circle of concern. I say that emotions concern our own most important goals and projects. So we're only going to have compassion for the people that we've already managed somehow, or we manage in the process of forming the emotion, to bring into our circle of goals and projects. So the question of what proper compassion is becomes part and parcel of the whole question, how broad should be our circle of concern? Now, I myself think it should be much broader than it usually is for most people, and so I'm very interested in the question, how can we extend our compassion from the narrow focus on our own family, our own neighborhood, our own group, and so on, to a broader circle of human beings, and what might be the obstacles in the way of doing that, and how can we grapple with those obstacles? So those are the kinds of questions that I try to ask in those chapters.
All right, so as you put it there, compassion is a crucial element in morality, but it's not reliable on its own, because
right.
the circle, as you put it, the circle of care, the circle of concern that you have, may be drawn too narrowly.
Right.
Well, maybe you can say a little bit about how you get from the place where that circle is drawn too narrowly to where you have it widened to the degree that you think it should be.
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, we have to figure out why it's sometimes too narrow. Now, one way that it might be too narrow is that we don't even really manage to appreciate how serious the suffering of other people are. And sometimes that's just through a failure of knowledge and a failure of imagination. So if I don't know anything about hunger in developing countries, I won't be able to have compassion for it because I just don't see that people are suffering anything serious. I don't know about it at all. Sometimes we get the judgment of fault wrong, because I might think, oh, poor people are poor because they brought it on themselves, and then I won't have compassion for them because I make what I think is a terrible blunder. I mean, at least in most cases it's a blunder. That is, I blame the poverty on the people who are poor. But another way that we might fail to have compassion is just by not having brought at all into our circle of concern other people. Now, how can we do this? Now, then I think we have to think first why we don't do this. And I think there are several reasons why we don't typically do this. First, I think just human beings tend to learn attachment from the inside out, so to speak, that we all, as young children, to develop into healthy, functioning human beings, we have to be strongly attached to a small group, at any rate, of adults in our surrounding. And it's only later that we are going to be able to generalize that, to move that outwards. And if we try to do away with that, which some philosophers have tried to do, I mean, like Plato thought, well, you get rid of the love in the family, and you're going to more easily have the broader circle, because then you can love everyone in the city equally if you don't have the competition of the family. I don't think that's wise, because I think then what you get, and this is something Aristotle already said in criticizing Plato, is an inability to love all round. You have to learn to love by starting at home and broaden it out from within. So that's one reason that the circle is narrow, because it starts from a narrow place, and unless we have some very careful effort to broaden it, it probably will just stay in that place. I think there's something else, that I think people tend to have a great deal of ambivalence towards their own human weakness, towards their lack of control over their surroundings, and one way this often manifests themselves is the creation of in-groups and out-groups. I talk about how emotions such as shame and disgust play a role in the demonizing of other groups in a society. And so when we are in a situation, and I think young children already often are in this situation, where we think, oh, we're in the in-group, and those people over there are in the out-group, and they're disgusting, and we don't like these kids who have cooties, and so on. So already those people are distanced by the very fact that we've drawn a line and we've said there's an in-group and an out-group. It's going to be much harder for people to have compassion for the people in the out-group once we've drawn that line. So any kind of demonizing of another group, any kind of saying that these are just thoroughly dirty or thoroughly evil, that's going to create even a more powerful impediment than already exists to the forming of compassion. So any education that's going to broaden compassion, I mean, suppose one thinks, for example, that one ought to be able to have at least some compassion for all human beings if one's going to think well about issues of global justice. You've got to grapple with these problems, and I think that means a big reform of education. So this is not unconnected to my writings on education, where I say we all need to learn a great deal more about how people are actually doing in other countries, and we need to learn it not just through sort of tables and statistics, but we need to learn it in a way that involves the imagination, because compassion is closely linked to an ability that I call empathy. Well, that is something that often the words get confused, but the way I define empathy is the imaginative ability to put yourself in the place of another, and I think that's not sufficient for compassion. Compassion involves more thoughts than just that, and in fact, you could also have a person who has empathy but no compassion. I mean, you could imagine a sadistic torturer who was very well able to imagine the sufferings of the victim but didn't have any compassion for them. So empathy is morally neutral, but I think it's a crucial part of becoming a compassionate person, because you're not going to be able to take the measure of the suffering that somebody else has unless you do learn to see the world from that person's viewpoint. So what I say is that education that involves literature, the arts, is a crucial part of teaching children and then gradually older people as well to have compassion for people at a distance, but also for groups in their own society that they have particular obstacles in coming to understand. And I think there again, the in-group and the out-group, we have to think, who are the so-called out-groups in our own society that we have tended to exclude and demonize? And then we have to focus education particularly on the process of coming to understand and sympathize with those groups.
I'm curious, how do you think the events of September the 11th changed our sense of compassion? Has it expanded it in some way, or narrowed it, or perhaps a bit of both?
Well, I think it is a bit of both. And I think that, you know, first of all, you do see a broadening beyond the local in the ability of all Americans to take seriously and grieve for the sufferings of New Yorkers, and New Yorkers of so many different types of national origin, ethnic origin, and so on. And then we find all sorts of interesting things happening, like the tremendous sympathy with the gay rugby player who was on the plane where they succeeded in bringing it down before it hit its target. Now, you know, even Americans who had no prior sympathy with gays and lesbians, I think that they were able to sympathize with that guy, and maybe that does involve a more long-term broadening in their feelings about who gay people are in our society and what they're capable of. So I thought we saw a lot of broadening, but at the same time, of course, there's the danger that it's so focused on the national boundary. And will it just stop at the national boundary? Now, we see, of course, that there's some movements of sympathy and curiosity about the real conditions of people in other countries. And I must say, as a feminist, I've been with other feminists talking about the situation of women in Afghanistan for some time, and no one was particularly listening. And now people are listening, and they care about that more than they did. So that was a broadening. But at the same time, there is a kind of tribal line-drawing, in-group mentality that so easily can take over. Let me just give an example. When I was at a baseball game in Chicago, it was the first baseball game played in Comiskey Park after the events, and the Yankees were there. Well, of course, first of all, it was very extraordinary that Chicagoans cheered for the Yankees. I mean, that was a broadening, if you want, that you rarely would see. But then as the game went on, there was this kind of chanting of USA, USA, as though what the political realm involved was two teams. A good team that was only the USA, like forgetting that all people all over the world have reasons to be appalled at terrorism, and we have many active allies and so on. And then there was, you know, these bad guys, and they were just kind of indeterminate bad guys. We weren't curious about what the situation was. And then at one moment, the umpire made a bad call against the White Sox, and these same fans said to the umpire, USA, USA, as though there was a kind of indiscriminate force of bad in the world, and anyone who thwarts our purposes of our fandom is a bad guy. And so I think you can just see from that kind of case how unthinking the line drawing is that people sometimes do, and how there's a kind of erotic investment in one's own team that becomes extremely powerful. Marcus Aurelius, who was a great writer about our love of humanity as a whole, he said his first lesson in the love of humanity was not to be a fan of the greens and blues at the races or of the light-armed and heavy-armed gladiators at the circus. So this Roman guy, he already knew the danger of fandom and how that will impede the cosmopolitan, if you want, imagination in trying to come to terms with the equal worth of all human life.
In the last 2 minutes, I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about what might be some of the other emotions that were brought about. I mean, you mentioned earlier shame and disgust, or perhaps you'd want to talk about fear or revenge. Just explore maybe one of those and how your account would help us think a little more clearly about them in this context.
Well, let me talk about disgust, because I think it's a particularly interesting one, and one that I'm actually working more on now. Here again, the emphasis on thought takes us a lot further than we can go if we don't think about the emotions that way. People might think disgust is surely very visceral, has no thought in it at all. It just means you want to throw up. Well, but really, if you think about it harder, and this is something psychologists have done a lot of experimental work on, disgust involves a thought of contamination. And what is involved in disgust, as contrasted with mere distaste, is the idea that the self will be contaminated by contact with something that's foreign or unsuitable. And then, if we once understand that there is this complicated and often quite magical thinking about contamination involved in the emotion of disgust, we can think better about how it happens that from being disgusted at, let's say, feces and other bodily fluids, we somehow find ourselves at times being disgusted by other human beings. We say of groups of human beings, they're smelly, they're foul, they're loathsome. Well, how does that come apart? How come about? How do we extend our thought from the kind of primary objects of disgust, like feces, to other groups of people? What is the dynamic that's at work there? And so I try to think about both the damage that dynamic does and how we might try to undo it, or at least prevent it from taking over in society and prevent it from becoming such a pervasive source of law and social custom. So that's one of the ones that I find particularly interesting, and I think we have to talk about it if we're also going to talk about love and compassion.
Okay, you've got about 30 seconds. You want to wrap up? Make any last
okay.
point?
Yeah, I think, I guess what I'd like to say in the end is that I think thinking about the thought content of emotions gives us a lot of sense of how we might create a stronger society, because it just is not the case that we're stuck with these emotions, that they're hardwired in us, that we have to have the hatred and disgust that we now have. We have a lot of power over what emotions children come to develop, and if we think better about what these emotions actually are, then I think we'll think a lot better about how we can educate them so as to be more socially productive than they now often are.
Well, thank you very much for appearing in the show again today.
Oh, thanks very much, you.
I've been speaking today with Martha Nussbaum, Ernst Freund, Distinguished Professor of Law and Philosophy at the University of Chicago. This is Hugh LaFollette, Fridays and Issues. Good day.